Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, Baseball Prospectus's local White Sox blog. This podcast is exclusively recorded in the wee hours of the night where laws are suspended and anyone can do whatever they want for a 24-hour period. You can find this podcast on iTunes by searching the Catbird Speaks or on Blog Talk Radio by searching as well. Joining me tonight during the purge is Colin Whitchurch in Austin, Texas.
What's up?
I've never seen those movies and I hate the concept. I don't know why I'm bringing them up.
Hey, who are you?
Oh, I'm James Fegan. I'm the editor of BP Southside. It's pretty late and I'm a little punchy. But I am in Elkhart, Indiana. I don't think it's an important detail who I am, what's my level of expertise, why should you keep listening to this podcast, have I ever watched a baseball game before?
Not important.
Also, whenever anybody like asks me if I watch the game these days, you know, maybe I'm getting too big for my britches, like, you know, I'm just, you know, a blogger at the end of the day. But like, after covering 7 seasons, anybody like to ask me that, I just respond like, no.
Yeah, just like casual people who like know you like baseball and saw the game and want to know if you watched it.
Yeah, well, I get like things like, have you ever even watched them? How can you say about them? I was like, not once. Avoid it whenever possible. I'm just pontificating online.
I just hate the, hey, did you see the game last night? It's like, yeah. Maybe you just want to make small talk with me about it, and I don't care about your opinion. But maybe I'm a snob.
You're talking about like coworkers.
Just coworkers, anyone, random family members.
I'll talk to coworkers, though. I don't encourage the idea of like a coworker, like, oh, you're talking to the biggest expert of all time.
Well, I sit around since my job revolves around sports. I'm constantly interacting with sports fans, so I think it makes it a little bit better. But anyway,
we could talk about this all day because like nothing's actually happening at the White Sox.
Nothing is happening.
They've been toast since like July, and now they're not even playing, you know, games that people are recording.
But they might have an award winner.
They might have an award winner. James Shields.
James Shields.
I got that mixed up. Adam Eaton is a finalist for the right field Gold Glove. Do they specify it for, like, spots now, right?
Yeah, they do spots, and it's him, Mookie Betts, and George Springer.
George Springer is obviously very athletic. I probably would not have put him in this group.
Is there still, I think, it seems like voters, who votes on the Gold Glove? Is it the BBWAA also? Probably, right?
I thought it was like a player vote.
Really?
This is why when we talk to coworkers, we shouldn't tout that whole expert thing.
But I feel like maybe, people have said for years that the Gold Glove, players get rewarded if they're more noteworthy offensively. And I don't know if that's necessarily the case anymore. I think that, I mean, obviously, if that were the case, then Beth was winning that award hands down. But
I mean, I think it's not so much like offensiveness as, you know,
recognition.
Awards go to people who have notoriety. My cat is here, by the way. Simba the cat is also on the podcast. And the easiest way to get notoriety is by being an offensive stud. So, like, there are more recognizable names whenever they are in the field to be considered. Looks like it's voted by managers and coaches each league.
Oh, okay. So, really just, like, an assistant of some sort, probably.
It is safe to conclude that Joe McEwen voted for all these awards.
I don't know. I mean, the Gold Glove is, as far as end of season awards go, it's probably, if not the one I care about the least, it's up there. I know, like, Fielding Bible has its own awards, and those go a little bit more into the metrics and whatnot, but I don't know. It'd be cool if you won it.
They have a whole show for it now.
Yeah. That's why they do the finalists. They do that with all the awards now, where they MLB Network kind of tries to build some suspense.
My presumption is that Mookie would win it, both because Mookie Betts is a phenomenal defender, literally a guy who could man center field with no problem, who just happens to be there in right field because Jackie Bradley Jr. is a god in center. And Mookie Betts is in a bigger, like, I don't know, I'm slipping into, you know, Reinsdorf talk to call Boston a bigger market than Chicago, but is on a more flagship franchise.
Yeah.
And he's a young superstar. He's a bigger name. But Adam Eaton really did get a lot of hype for his defense throughout the season. Like, that was the thing he was known for above his bat. When the White Sox started out hot, that was all people could talk about, was pointing out Adam Eaton. He was involved in a couple triple, or just the one triple play. Yeah, only one triple play actually involved him. And he led all of baseball and assist, so that's something that sticks out in people's memories, is, you know, because what outfielders to run on, which ones not to run on, is something that, you know, managers and coaches have to think out about a lot. So I definitely wouldn't say it's impossible. I might even say, like, 40% chance Eaton wins this. So that means that in real life Springer is going to win this for no reason at all.
The fact that the coaches vote on it makes it really weird, because it's like, I mean, it obviously depends on how much you see the guy or who made more plays against you. I guess if we're under the assumption that these managers and coaches are really putting more than, I don't know, 5 seconds of thought into it. But yeah, I don't know. I hope he wins, just because why not? But I think it's pretty much a toss-up, like you said.
Probably Mookie.
Just especially since he's, I don't know, he might win the MVP.
Really?
He's going to finish top three, right?
I'd definitely say top five. I suppose top three is a possibility.
Because people are going to, going off on a off topic here a little bit, but people aren't going to give it to Trout because there are too many people who still stand by the he played for a shitty team.
He finished, like, what, sixth in, like, the Sporting News' like player vote of Player of the Year?
Did he? I missed that completely.
It was something absurd.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, he's the notoriety guy. He's the one everyone knows and loves, and the offensive star and whatnot. So I would say him, then Eaton Springer tonight. But we'll find out.
Well, we squeezed 8 minutes out of that. Chris Cotillo?
MLB Trade Rumors, correct?
Cotillo? SB Nation Daily Dish.
Thank
you very much.
Apologies, Chris.
Delivered a bombshell today. Frankly, for me, you know, the scene in Saving Private Ryan where the mortar hits and Tom Hanks can't hear for a moment.
Yeah.
That's kind of like the moment I'm still in after hearing this news. Particularly, like, where all you see is gore silently. James Shields is opting into the last 2 years of his deal.
Which
will cost the White Sox at a minimum $22 million. He could always have a crazy turnaround to the point where they're, like, picking up his team option in 2019. But it seems unlikely at this point, with the information that they have available, that 37-year-old James Shields will be worth $60 million.
Yeah, I mean, we've all pretty much come to grips with the fact that they have to at least give him another shot in the rotation next year, right?
I mean, if nothing else, you bring him to spring and let him see if he's got anything back.
Yeah, I mean, It's kind of funny. It feels like it was an eternity ago at this point that everyone was like, oh, yeah, sure, why not? It's a good trade for the White Sox. They gave up, you know, a 4A starter and a lotto ticket for James Shields. But regardless of the return, the fact that they're stuck with that and pretty much have no other options to part ways with him other than hope, it's pretty depressing.
Has James Shields, you think, given serious thoughts of the idea that the White Sox are cursed and are ruining his career? Or is he reasoned that even if the White Sox were cursed and ruined his career, if he went out on his own, away from the cursed team, and found his magic again, he would still not earn more than the $40-something million he's going to make just by, like, staying on the cursed team?
Say he was a free agent after the season, what would he get on the open market?
After 2016?
Yeah, just after the season. This offseason, James Shields is a free agent.
Minor league deal. Like, why would you give a guarantee of money?
No, exactly.
I would give him an invite to camp. What's the, like, least commitment I can make?
Yeah. I mean, that kind of fall is kind of, I guess, the fact that it was so drastic. Like, obviously, he'd been in the decline for a few years now, but the fact that it went from, without any serious injury, the fact that he went from decent to above average starter to, like, DFA level starter at least gives you a little bit of hope that there was something lingering that he's going to fix this offseason. But I don't know. I feel like I'm just kind of grasping at straws with that kind of hope.
There are guys who got DFA'd who pitch better than him.
Yeah. I mean, he was worse than John Danks.
Yes, he was worse than everybody. Like, there was no qualify, like, he had a 59 ERA plus in Chicago.
And there's no, it's like, if James Shields were, like, a Dodger or a Red Sox, then they would probably just give him his money and say, see you later. But
I think any team brings him the spring and see if he can find anything and works him out and tries to iron out some kinks.
Yeah. Bring him to spring is probably correct, but like, how far, what are the White Sox options? They come to spring, they even start the year in the rotation, and he stinks again. What do they do?
Are you baiting me to make a segue?
Yeah. Well, that wasn't intentional, but sure, why not?
Like, I feel baited.
We'll take it then.
It doesn't feel natural to me. Like, I want it to be, you know, authentic. And now you're here, you know, you're forcing this on me. Something that I wasn't ready to necessarily discuss.
It was not intentional. We gave 8 minutes to Gold Glove Talk. How much do you want to talk about the fact that James Shields sucks and the White Sox are stuck with him?
You know, based on a normal episode time, you know, 45 to 50 minutes.
All right. Well, what more do you got to say?
His curveball looked good at times. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, it looked good when it was not sailing out of the ballpark.
So this week we released the BP Southside off-season plan.
That was a better transition.
No. But, like, at this point, the dream of, like, a... Your actual initial transition was very smooth. I don't know why I resisted it. It just...
I know.
I can't let myself be happy.
And I swear to God, it was not intentional. I wasn't thinking about that. I'm not as smart as that made me seem.
Maybe I was just trying to stall so I could look this up. Yeah, out of any all qualified pitchers, Shields is the worst ERA plus. This is including the San Diego time where he was essentially okay. He had a 69 ERA plus.
If you I wonder how far you need to lower the minimum innings pitch for him to not be the worst.
So the next two guys are Jared Weaver, who's extremely toast.
Yeah.
And Wade Miley, who also was traded at the deadline for rotation help, only to be awful.
Yeah.
So the offseason plan, it was kind of collaborative amongst all of us. Definitely kind of the stretch run that kind of commandeered the ship a little bit.
It was mostly James yelling at us in the Slack with ideas, and everyone just kind of going,
It's like, I have this plan, I'm going to do this and this, and then, like, Nick yelling, like, sign Steve Pierce!
Yeah.
And then I did. But in the Slack, or, sorry, in the offseason plan, you know, there's no getting rid of James Shields. He can't be traded. You're financially obligated to run with him. And when you have your start, your top four of the rotation set with Sale, Quintana, Rodon, and Miguel Gonzalez, there's not really like room to offer someone like a guaranteed spot or a guaranteed contract for a spot that doesn't exist. Like someone we brought up a little bit was R.A. Dickey as far as being a back end guy who would just eat innings. So, but why is R.A. Dickey going to come in and fight for a rotation spot?
Yeah.
Because if, you know, Shields comes back and it's just like, he had like a 95 ERA plus in San Diego. If he's that, you're extremely happy.
And you have a really good rotation.
So, you have a really good rotation, and you're happy because this guy that you're paying $11 million to can basically do the job. Do a job.
Making more than anyone in the rotation except for Chris Sale.
Yeah, Sale's finally bumping up to over $10 million a season this year.
So, I guess
he's going to start ordering soups and salads before meals at dinner. And he's going to bulk up.
Yeah. So essentially what we're talking about then is depth. Trying to find guys who are not as bad as the Jacob Turners and Anthony Renatos of the world. And there aren't a lot of options.
Oh, I mean, there's never great options when you're searching the minor league deal field. So,
sure.
I mean, those guys are available for minor league deals for a reason. The two guys I selected were Tommy Malone and John Neese, with also a mention of Henderson Alvarez. Henderson Alvarez is probably good if he can pitch, but that has been a long time since he was physically able. Tommy Malone is just a low ceiling change of command guy, and the sort you can kind of always convince yourself that the White Sox could patch up and point in the direction of the plate and be fine for a little bit. Mostly signing him would mean that the White Sox would prevent him from catching on with some random AL Central team and flipping seven innings of one run ball on them three times a season. Basically the Ryan Rayburn, like, you know, corollary. A reason to sign a guy just to make him stop punishing you.
The Bruce Chen.
Yeah.
Chen wasn't as good as against the White Sox as people made him out to be. He's had a couple of random good outings. Tommy Malone is who did he end the season with last year? With the Angels. He was with Minnesota.
Yeah. So getting kicked out of the Minnesota rotation is not a compliment.
He will be 30 at the start of next season. Like you said, he's just kind of a command and control guy who you kind of throw out there and hope that he won't kill you. He actually wasn't bad in 2015 in 128 innings. Do you think, well, I guess after his 2016 season, but even with, because of the how terrible the starting pitcher market is, don't you think that he'll get more than a minor league deal somewhere, or no?
I don't think so. He was really ineffective. I don't know. Yeah. When the Twins say no mas, I don't know what rotation is more desperate than that one?
Desperate than that one.
He's I get him and another twin mixed up. Is he the guy who gives up a ton of dingers alone?
That would be easy to confuse that with other twins. Can you be more specific?
I just feel like I get him.
Are you confusing him with Phil Hughes?
No, not Phil Hughes. Nolasco, maybe?
Okay. Alaska's right-handed.
That's true. Anyway, let's move on from my stupidity.
I mean, I'm not that attached particularly to Tommy Malone. It's more a concept. You just got to find formerly successful warm bodies and hope you can slap together something within 10% of league average.
You just have to know that there's a... I mean, you need more than five guys who can start getting it. There's a basically zero chance that that happens, and you have to find the guys who are going to suck the least. And the White Sox's ability to identify that is important because their depth all around the diamond, and particularly in the starting rotation. Can you imagine if they didn't get Miguel Gonzalez for nothing right before the season started last year? Like, finding those guys is really important.
Yeah, they'd be in the market for a free agent starter, which would be bad because those are really expensive.
Yeah, and the best one is Rich Hill, and then after that, probably Jeremy Hellickson.
Yeah, yeesh. Imagine giving up a draft pick for Jeremy Hellickson. I say this as someone who's not very confident about him at the moment. And is unsure whether he will be a starter ultimately, but you will start the season with Carson Fulmer making starts in AAA. If he doesn't, twirl like 12 good innings in spring training and they just panic and give him the job. So it's not like you don't want to put something in the way of him, but it's not like you have a black hole with no plan or no future view for that spot. I mean, ideally, things, solidify him for him a bit, and he's capable of being a number five, mid late season. I wouldn't put a lot of eggs in that basket, but that is your future next rotation add if we're following along with what the White Sox current developmental plan is. Just put it out there.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think that they are going to, whether it's next season or late next season or sometime down the road, they're gonna give him every opportunity in the world to start before they get out. Like you said, I have some serious doubts about whether that's going to happen, and people smarter than me who I've talked to also have those serious doubts. But it's nice that it's nice that it's not a sure thing that he's not a starter, that they still have that option and they can still give him a shot at some point if he progresses like they hope he should.
Also, we're saying, while I love Miguel Gonzalez, very great next season, we show up next year and he can't get outs anymore, would not be the most shocking thing.
Yeah, I was thinking that exact thing.
Complimentary thing that the compliment that Craig Goldstein gave to him was, his stuff's not very good, but he has cojones. So that type of guy is kind of like, walking the razor's edge as far as staying an effective major league pitcher.
For sure. I mean, it's hard to... it's really unbelievable that the Orioles of all teams just completely gave up on him, but their ability to identify pitching talent has been about as successful as the White Sox ability to draft and develop hitting talent.
I mean, he's definitely not a guy who just skill jumps out with you, and if he's not, like, throwing strikes or commanding well, he can definitely turn into a pinata pretty quickly. So it's not like, you know, giving up on Arrieta level.
No, definitely not. But, I mean, they were giving multiple starts to Ubaldo Jimenez and Giovanni Gallardo toward the end of the season while competing for a playoff spot. And they obviously could have used Miguel last season.
Hey, you know that team that traded for Wade Miley midseason for rotation help?
Exactly.
That was the Orioles.
He was like the first left-handed starter to pitch for Baltimore in like 2 years or something like that.
Now they won't go back.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I mean, I think we've summed up the rotation pretty well. You know, solid three. They got a roll of Gonzalez after what he gave them this year. They've got to hope and pray that James Shields is improved in some way or bounces back in some way, and then throw as many lotto tickets out there and hope that one of them can provide you with some quality innings.
Yeah, it's definitely most of the attention of the plan was on the potential player side. I pissed away the White Sox 12th overall draft pick on 4 years of Dexter Fowler because he's really the top center, pure center fielder available, and will allow them to stick in their super defensive situation where Adam Eaton plays right field and wins Gold Gloves. Also, Fowler had an extremely great OBP this year and would boost that and could hit in the top of the order, get on base. And even better, he's extremely effective against left-handed pitching as a switch hitter, which would help, given my plans to stock up on platoon bats as a way of avoiding, like, having to pay full salary for, like, someone like Edwin Encarnacion. So I basically traded for or signed 4 years of Fowler and signed both Pedro Alvarez, who slugged over .500 against lefty or righties last year to basically be the platoon DH. Signed Steve Pierce as kind of utility guy who had like some absurd like 170 weighted runs created plus against lefties last year, and they could mix and match. Who's the other person hitter I signed? I think it was, catching was an absolute disaster. I hated every second of trying to consider what catcher to get. Matt Wieters and what's his face?
Jason Castro
were the top catches available, and neither one of them even sniffed league average offense this year. And I'd have to like commit like at least 3 years to both of them, as well as like, I guess I wouldn't have to give a QO or lose a draft pick for Castro, but definitely for Wieters. It's, and then I'd be betting on Castro's like framing remaining elite, like for the length of the contract. And Wieters has already had like a knee injury and he's having declining defensive performance. It just all was bad. So I decided to just get a really cheap, bad catcher, Nick Hundley, who might hit okay, but otherwise it's just kind of like a veteran right-handed guy to go with Omar Navarez.
So I think we should probably clarify, as I can't remember if you did in your piece or not, that this is what we think they should do, not necessarily what we think they will do.
Right. Kind of any issue with any offseason plan is kind of walking that line.
Sure. But yeah, it's what we realistically think they should do. I mean, obviously, what they could do is throw tons of money at Yoenis Cespedes and Edwin Encarnacion, but we're trying to realistically build a roster based on what we know about the management and the payroll structure and whatnot. But the reason I bring that up is because I don't think there's any way in hell, even if I think they should do it, I don't think there's any way in hell that they're forfeiting a draft pick this year. They wouldn't do it last year for the 26th pick. There's no way in hell they're going to do that this year.
And, you know, that's a problem I kept running into.
Yeah.
Is that I'm signing Dexter Fowler when it would have been, you know, possibly half as expensive to get him last year. With a only give up the 26th pick for him, and would have gotten a prime season out of him. Now I'm getting him a year older. I might be even harder to get four quality years out of him. And I have to like reassess his catching situation the year after they just like punted on framing and, you know, totally jacked up the pitching staff and screwed over, you know, the development of Rodon for half the year with that. And so there's some degree of, well, basically I'm just going to undo what they did in 2016. And, you know, it's really hard to see a front office just kind of like admitting like, well, we screwed that up, and just kind of like going against every like trend and instinct, like all of a sudden breaking out the checkbook for Dexter Fowler, even though he's the same guy he was last year. I mean, it just so happens that, you know, if you wanted a framing catcher who hit decently, who would be theoretically available for a trade, it would be Tyler Flowers, because he's playing a rebuilding team. Now, the Braves aren't like, and they're farther along in the rebuilding where they're not stripping everything down right at this moment. So it would be kind of like they're willing to trade Tyler Flowers than they need to. It might be more expensive, but that would be a target to go. But that would be a open rebuke of the logic that was put in place when you non-tendered Tyler Flowers. All of a sudden, he's a valuable catcher on a you'd be admitting that this is like a, you know, a decent starting catcher on an affordable deal when previously you didn't think he was worth $4 million. And so realistically, we can't see a front office doing that. But if we just take of like a realistic approach of what the White Sox have done in recent years, then I would make some fringy trade that may or may not work if some guy hits like his 80th percentile like result, and then not put enough around it and then win 75 games. And at that point, what's the point of going through the motions of that kind of exercise?
Yeah, the catching position is just across the league, free agency and even in trade options, is so remarkably pathetic. And I mean, shit, the Indians started Roberto Perez for most of the year and he's clocking dingers in the World Series. So I understand that it's possible to win without an elite catcher, but you need someone back there who is A, going to stay healthy, and B, not going to completely murder you both offensively and defensively, and that's what the White Sox have struggled to find.
I'll get into a little bit more what I did depth-wise, catcher, kind of anticipating that Nick Hundley is going to be bad.
Sure.
But part of the logic in giving up a draft pick is this, that if you swear off all the talent in the free agent market that is going to get a qualifying offer, you're not going to be able to get, you know, team-changing talent through free agency. You can get like bit pieces there. You can get Pedro Alvarez to be a platoon bat and be kind of a nice offensive piece who hits lots of homers that everyone loves, but maybe isn't that purely valuable because he can only really provides one thing. So to get like a Dexter Fowler guy who stabilizes center field and the top of the lineup at the same time, those guys are going to have QOs. If you swear off that tier of talent, you're going to have to get that in trade. So to get that tier of talent in trade, you're going to give up a legitimate prospect. So yes, you're hurting, you're taking away some of your minor league depth by not getting a first round pick this year, but you're just going to pay that from the same like crop in another way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like saving your draft pick, is your draft pick going to be better than Marcus Semien to, you know, trade for Jeff Samardzija? Is your draft pick going to be better, more valuable than Trace Thompson? Maybe. Maybe not. Like, that's not really, like, there's not really a great bit that, like, your 26 pick or your 12th pick is going to be more valuable at any point, or especially not at this moment in time, than an MLB-ready Trace Thompson, than an MLB-ready Marcus Semien.
Yeah, if you're talking purely 2017, then the answer is obviously the QO3 agent.
I'm just saying you're paying your prospect depth somewhere. You're either paying it because you're giving up draft picks, or you're taking it right out of your system directly to trade for it.
Yeah, and that's exactly, like you said, what the White Sox have done because of the refusal to sign free agents is, yeah, maybe they haven't given up any superstars in trades for Frazier and trades for Samardzija, but that lack of depth hurt them a lot the last couple of years, and the White Sox have straddled this line for so long between not wanting to spend free agents and also not wanting to trade the top prospects, that it's, If you're afraid to go consistently in one direction, you're going to end up with a team that finishes with one of the 10 to 15 worst records in baseball, and that's exactly what they've done.
Yeah, and I don't want to give up a higher draft pick when I could have given up a lower one last year, but I have to look at last year as not enough was done to make this team win, and we need to do more, and we need to overcorrect rather than try to do the least possible, because that's not working. And even with that mentality, I kind of cheaped out. Like, I didn't make any pursuit for a top free agent like Yonis Cespedes or Encarnacion, because I kind of like went to the approach of, this team has the top-level guys it needs to win. This team already has the best overall player on the team, a good second best player on the team, a good third best, a good fourth best player on the team. I just need to remove the black holes. So I got a lot of guys and stacked them on top of each other who can replicate their roles. Like, I don't need to worry about Brent Lowry like tanking because I have Tyler Saldino I can bring off the bench. Or I don't need to worry about Tyler Saldino is kind of like the last line of defense for a lot of, like, if Tim Anderson is a huge step back, then I have to rely on Tyler Saldino. Brett Lurie is a big step back. I kind of have to rely on Tyler Saldino. I guess I can bring up Carlos Sanchez. Steve Pierce played some second base last year, but I'm pretty sure if I'm running him out there every day, shit has hit the fan, and at that point I'm just trying to wipe everything up with baby wipes. But I'm protected against Pedro Alvarez crashing a bit by Steve Pierce. I'm protected against Melky Cabrera getting old all at once by Pierce and Fowler, and having maybe Tilson off the bench could play a D-first center fielder. I'm just trying to layer and having layers of protection against the inevitable, you know, guy having an awful season that in the past the White Sox had no protection against.
Yeah, it's not spots 1 through 5 on the 25-man roster that the White Sox have to worry about. It's positions 10 through 20. It's getting the good players to surround the stars that they already have. I think that, you know, I think that Dexter Fowler being the centerpiece of your offseason is a fine way to do that, because nobody's going to mistake Dexter Fowler for a game-changing center fielder. But when you put him on a team of stars, like, say, I don't know, the 2015 Cubs, you know, he has value, and he would definitely have value on the White Sox.
I mean, he's very, very good. I really like him. But he made the All-Star team this year. But that could easily be the only All-Star game he makes in his career.
For sure.
And that's, you know, a very good, above-average role player. And if that's a guy who's just, like, beyond the pale to ever sign free agency, you know, what are we doing here?
What are we doing here?
Because, you know, the Cubs have done, you know, as good a job as anyone will see in the last 10 years developing homegrown position players. And even they have to reach out for guys like that and do. So people want to ape the model of, you know, the fire rebuild. People should also ape the model of grabbing mid-tier free agents to fill out holes on your roster.
It's going to be a shit show if, I mean, I just remember last year, even me, which, you know, who the fuck am I? You know, was screaming for them to sign Dexter Fowler and comments and tweets. And you can't give up the 26th pick for this guy. And if there's talk about them doing that for the 12th, people are going to lose their damn minds. And screw them, you know. Because I think they should. but it's gonna be something to see. And also screw them if it works out and they actually are contenders.
People,
we're gonna get tweets after people with this podcast saying I don't want to give up the 12th pick for Dexter Fowler.
People are overvaluing the 12th pick as being like the best thing you can get from a 12th pick.
No, absolutely.
Like Marcus Semien, if you got that kind of player from the 12th pick, that's a good result. That's a major leaguer. That's like a long term up the middle major leaguer. And you know, you traded him instead for your Jeff Samardzija. Like mid-tier prospects are something that people seem to be able to stomach, giving away in trades, but seem to somehow think that draft picks are something else.
Yeah, like you hope the 12th pick becomes a mid-tier prospect.
I mean, you want it to be a high-level prospect, but like,
no, I'm saying like that's a reasonable outcome for the 12th pick.
I shouldn't say mid-tier prospects, like MLB-ready role players. I guess would be a better way to describe what they gave up with Thompson and even Frankie Montas and and Semien. Like, those guys are not going to be studs. Montas is probably going to be a good reliever if he can ever stop purging ribs out of his body. But those guys are not bad results for the type of, like, draft picks we're talking about giving up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I definitely wish that we had managed the situation better, where we weren't not, like, didn't need to give up a 12th pick, but we haven't, and we can't keep, you know, whatever the phrase is about cutting off your ears despite your face. it's late.
Do you want to, it is late, and do you want to go in any more into some of, see, we mentioned Fowler, we mentioned Alvarez, we mentioned Pierce.
I couldn't, hold my nose to trade for Tyler Flowers, I basically got a bunch of lottery tickets on catcher. I think we all are kind of secretly hoping Narvaez can stay getting on base and be the kind of catcher that Carlos Rodon was raving out behind the plate long term. I'm not really convinced he's that good throwing out base runners, and he's probably at best a little bit above average framer rather than like some elite guy. But you kind of enter in that hoping he can take control of the position, but probably like absolute ceiling would be a one win type of catcher.
Yeah.
So I traded for some lottery tickets. I traded Yanoa to the Dodgers for Austin Barnes, who's basically a blocked 27-year-old who has crushed the PCL. But has basically done nothing in the majors and definitely doesn't have like the loud tools to make. There's a reason that they start Yasmani Grandal, not him. But he'd be a decent guy to have in AAA to see if there's anything real to his PCL mastery at the plate. And at Mauricio Rubio's suggestion, I traded for Reese McGuire, who he told me that his love for his defense, possibly the best defensive catcher in the minor leagues, as far as like, great framer, great throwing out base runners, great, very smooth actions. And I was asking him like, who I have to trade for this. He's like, Spencer Adams, Tyler Danish level. And he had told me he can't hit. I was like, how am I getting this guy, the best defensive prospect catcher in the minor leagues, for Tyler Danish? He's like, so now you appreciate how much you can't hit.
So he's like catcher Brendan Ryan.
Yeah. Possibly worse hitting.
I mean, with a position like catcher, to a smaller extent, you almost treat it a lot like the back end of the rotation if you're the White Sox, and with the options that they have available, where you just kind of throw a bunch of shit at the wall and hope one of them sticks.
It's basically a bunch of backups.
Yeah. I mean, it's better, especially with the kind of younger to semi-younger guys. I like it a lot better than relying on old, broken veterans who are obviously and fatally flawed, like Amelia and Navarro, or Lotto tickets in depth, and hoping that one of them ends up sticking there is probably a more reasonable option. This is a little bit out of left field, but since we're talking about the position, what the hell is Wilson Ramos going to get this offseason with that injury?
I don't know, because...
He'll take it, probably.
Not only do you not know when he'd be back, or when he'd be able to, like, see regular action, what's his future? Can he keep catching? He wasn't, like, Mr. Super-Duper Athletic beforehand, and he had some amusing quotes basically saying, like, you know, I really didn't take my conditioning that seriously until realizing that I was up for free agency this year, which is refreshingly honest, but
yeah,
just not like a huge, like, we always thought he had talent. I'm really happy that he mashed, because it makes the already funny Matt Capps for Wilson Ramos trade that the Twins did near the end of the run funnier. But he's not a guy I would necessarily say, like, this is a super duper catcher he's going to catch forever.
Yeah.
He's a big dude.
I just wonder if he's going to get a QO, and also if he's going to take it. You'd have to imagine that if he gets it, he's going to take
it. Yeah. And also, like, he hit extremely well this season. So it'd be one thing if, like, you know, he was a 90 weighted runs created plus type of guy and he made his living by catching. But, like, if the bat's that legit and you're worried about his knee, do you even risk having him catch at this point? Because, you know, if he's consistently, what absurd, like, I don't know what his hitting numbers finished up at. I'm going to check it out. Because he's like...
He had a 123 OPS plus.
Because he was at 140 at one point in the season.
Yeah.
If there's consistency to that bat, which there probably isn't, because he was, even having that monster year, put him back on league average for his career. But, you know, if he was a big bat guy, if he was really breaking out 28, maybe you move that guy to first.
Yeah.
So it's just a lot of uncertainty to me, and I didn't want to touch it.
I think that's very
good. Because knowing the White Sox kind of already being avoiding a free agency, and the fact that my budget was already was already high to the point where people were kind of like, look at me, like, what are you thinking? There really weren't any room for me to take risk. I acquired a lot. I paid for certainty.
Sure. Hey,
I also paid for Boone Logan.
Oh yeah, you were going to give him way too much money too, and so I think Ethan talked you down, didn't he?
Well, I always just assume, like, I don't want to be the guy who's like, yeah, I'm going to sign Dexter Fowler for 7 years or 3 years. I'm only have to pay him for 2 years, and he's going to accept like $5 million. Like, I always want to, like,
you want to over guess.
I want to err on the side of, like, you know, overly harsh.
Sure.
Because, like, oh, I built a 110-win team, and then I only have an $85 million payroll. Like, maybe you didn't, like, make your signings difficult enough.
So because they really need a left-handed reliever. Yes. Dan Jennings isn't a loser.
He's left-handed, but he does not have big splits. Boone Logan demolishes left-handers. His splits are pronounced enough that, you know, you kind of wonder the logistics of using him. Like, how often do you get away with using him full innings? Because he still strikes people out, but his home runs and walks spike. Against righties.
Yeah.
But you definitely want to give your manager a tool of, like, oh, you need a left-hander out. Here's your guy.
Yeah. The nice thing about the bullpen going into 2017 is that unless they suffered some sort of injuries that are going to make them never be the same again, you kind of are adding two de facto free agents and just having Putnam and Patrichka both healthy again for the start of the season, if they are.
Putnam, definitely big time.
Yeah.
Patrichka, I'm not really counting on being much better than my sixth reliever.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. But Putnam, I mean, all things being equal this year, probably would have been the third man out of the bullpen this year, behind Robertson and Jones all season if he had stayed healthy. Would have seen a whole hell of a lot less of Matt Albert with him on the roster, or with Patrichka on the roster. So you don't need to do a whole lot this offseason with the bullpen other than, you know, depth guys that every bullpen needs. And they've got a few guys in the system who could potentially be average major league relievers. I think the big question about the bullpen, or I don't know if it's even necessarily a question, but the thing that at least some people are going to ask is if they shop David Robertson. And you addressed that a little bit too.
Yeah. So the whole idea is that I'm looking at this roster and I'm trying to make a winner. Like, I'm under the idea that I need to win in 2017. So kind of like long-term goals of clearing out salary are secondary. So David Robertson is not a good value right now. We're paying him high-level closer money. He's not a high-level closer. He's been kind of like a below-average closer. Not a terrible reliever, but someone you'd wish you had a better closer on, to the point you're significantly suggested to give his role to Nate Jones. But probably the thing I liked as much as anything about Robin was how he used Nate Jones. Very, very aggressive on using Nate Jones in situations where he needed him. And it's hard to get managers to operate that way, and I wouldn't want to touch it. But I'm getting off point. You need a closer. You need more high-level relievers. My probable hot take about this bullpen at this moment is that if Nate Jones, something happens to Nate Jones, this could get really ugly really quickly.
Oh, yeah.
So you need more elite guys who can handle high-leverage situations. Now, maybe you've lost faith in Robertson being that guy, which is not, you know, an invalid opinion. But if that's the case, you need to replace him. So if you're trading Robertson to clear out money to go get that guy, you are probably eating some of his $12 million salary next year. Because who's going to want to take that on just in full? I mean, maybe you do that, but then you're in a situation like Alex Rios or the Alex Rios trade from way back where by seeking out someone who will take on his full salary, you're basically giving out, you're not going to get anything of value back. So you're basically just giving David Robertson away to possibly rebound somewhere else just because you don't want to pay for him.
And you're kind of spinning in circles too because, okay, we want to save $12 to $25 million, so let's get rid of David Robertson. Okay, now we have a pull in our bullpen, so we're either going to throw money at it or we're going to throw prospects at it. So, and like you said, I mean, I love Nate Jones, and I think Nate Jones has the potential to be one of the top relievers in the American League, but it's nice to have that that flexibility with him, where if you were to get rid of David Robertson, even if though it would free up money, then you're automatically inserting Nate Jones into the closer role, and he could be, who knows, a really elite level closer in the league, but you take away some of that flexibility of 6th, 7th, 8th inning high leverage situation. You need an out guy, which is what he is and can continue to be.
And what are you replacing him with? Because I'm looking at the free agent crop for relievers, and I'm not seeing anybody who resembles that guy.
Matt Albers. Yeah, no, I thought you hung up on me when I said that for a second. The sound went off.
I guess you got Mark Melanson and Kenley Jansen. You're not getting those guys for cheaper than $12 million.
No, you're not.
Next year. And you're paying a draft pick for them, likely. Especially Kenley.
The only thing I worry about, and again, you know, this is more speaking to how I feel about the White Sox management than this plan. The only thing I worry about is that they're going to already be pinching pennies to improve the team to begin with, that they're going to have this $12 million tied up for 2017, and they're not going to do shit because, I mean, not specifically because of Robertson, but just because their payroll is too high. And I know your final payroll that you came up with in this plan was pretty high, but, I mean, fuck it.
It's $140 million, which if they started, if you put that into the 2016 opening day payrolls, they're in a virtual dead heat with Seattle for 12th, biggest in Major League Baseball.
But it would also be the highest opening day payroll in White Sox history.
Which, how relevant do I really think that is?
No, I'm playing devil's advocate with you here.
I know,
but
I'm saying, and that would be my rebuke.
Okay, yeah.
You're not competing with previous White Sox teams, you're competing with the league, and if you're maxed out, we're winning this year season is not like you balk at the idea of being like above median payroll. I think you need to do that teardown because your roster is not built in that way where you can be. You have a very good core that's affordable. You don't have like everyone's in pre-arb type of affordable. Like you have a bunch of guys in their late 20s. That are ready to win now or at their peak, but yeah, you're not paying like your best player $500,000. So if that's the level, if that's how inexpensive things need to be, then yeah, you do need to start again because you need to be the Rays on steroids. Rounding out the point about Robertson, just thinking like that I would have to probably pay as much to replace him with Melanson or Jansen or more, likely more, and possibly a draft pick. I look at Robertson, the guy, you know, I definitely didn't like his performance, but he struck out over 28% of his batters in 2016. He's 32 years old. These are not factors I look at and think this guy is totally cooked. There's ability left, and why would I think a reliever is done at 32 necessarily? I see better opportunity to maybe you switch his role a little bit and take him out of the ninth inning if just things don't recover for him. But I see more opportunity and take a chance on him. And I didn't put Zach Birdie on the 25-man to start the year, but that's definitely a key thing, is him being a contributor on a team by midseason. I don't say that's a requirement, but that's a big factor for this roster playing up better than it looks right now.
Yeah, if he can come up and be I agree with you that relying on him to be a big contributor in the bullpen right off the bat in 2017 would be a mistake, but just like Fulmer in the rotation, having him as, I don't know if I'd necessarily want to call it a fallback option, but having him as an option, you know, when injuries happen and depending on their development, back there is kind of a nice, I don't know, crutch, whatever you want to call it.
So if I'm watching the playoffs right now, and I'm watching the Indians with Andrew Miller logging like super innings and Cody Allen still being a very good closer. I'm looking at my bullpen and thinking, I like Nate Jones a lot. Nate Jones is not Andrew Miller. And he probably can't give me three innings on a regular basis throughout the playoffs. That I really need three high level super guys that I can rely on high leverage throughout a night. So I'm really hoping that maybe it's Putnam. I definitely think Putnam is, a playoff rotation reliever. But I'm hoping that Birdie is that guy by the end of the season. Because he's got the stuff for it. So it's really just like sharpening his command, and that can happen pretty quickly.
For sure. And if you're not going to have a super reliever, a Miller type reliever, then having a bunch of pretty good ones or a bunch of really good ones is probably your next best option.
Look at me discussing the White Sox in the playoffs. They're more absurd scenario. I think spending $140 million is more realistic.
Is there anything else we need to talk about? I like how this has kind of turned into like me interviewing you about your offensive plan. This is like the most professional sounding podcast I think we've ever had.
Except for, you know, like the audio issues.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I'm good.
Same.
All right. Until next time, look for this podcast on iTunes. Look for The Catbird Speaks and search for it also on Blog Talk Radio or just download it from our site. Subscribe, because we do it infrequently, so it's hard to keep up.